listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Welcome to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast from Los Angeles. Here, I'm Sarah Claspel, the only person to ever host this podcast. I was the guest on the last episode, but today, guess what? I'm still the host, as always. My guest today is Alex Fernie, who improv fans might know from Sentimental Lady, Convoy, and the show Required Viewing. Welcome, Alex.
Hello, thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. You know what? I'm good. How are you?
I'm great.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Had a good morning.
Yeah, that's nice.
Excited to have you on, as always. This
excited
is my podcast. So let's chat prov. What got you into? I know you started in college, perhaps before
high school. Yeah, high school. When I moved from New Hampshire to Rhode Island in between my freshman and sophomore year of high school, and I moved from this huge public school in Keene, New Hampshire, to sort of a small artsy fartsy like private school. And when I moved there, honestly, in the first couple weeks, I'd met some people. It was a small school, and some very nice kids who I remained friends with throughout high school were like, "Oh, you should come and do this improv club." I'd done school plays and stuff, and I was like, "All right, you're the three people I've met. I'll go do that." And then did short form improv in the basement of the library, and that was how I started doing it. I'd known it from Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get an audience at the library?
We honestly, it was interesting. It was every now and then we would do shows. I don't out in this courtyard area, but it was mainly a fun thing. It wasn't there was a director or a coach or anything. It was just kind of like, well, let's just play improv games and then sometimes do these shows. But I think even if that shows hadn't existed, probably still would have done this nerdy thing in this library basement.
Mm-hmm. So when you, that was in high school, you said?
Yeah, that was high school.
So when you got to college, was your aim to continue doing improv, or was it something that they also had?
No, it wasn't. They also had it. In college, there was one improv group when I was there. There was a bunch of sketch teams, but there was one improv group. I was planning on being a theater major, and I threw that out the window very fast. mainly because I met other theater majors, and I was like, "This is not for me."
What did you major in instead?
History.
Ah.
But there was an improv group. I auditioned for it my freshman year and didn't get on. And then my sophomore year, I auditioned and I got on, and that was also short form. But by the end of college, everyone had seen shows at UCB in the city, and a few people had seen shows at IO, and someone had read Truth in Comedy, and so we were trying to reverse engineer our way back into what long form improv was, and that was my first experience with that, just bumbling around. Well, what if we removed the gimmicks of the short form game and just did longer things and tried to figure it out on our own?
Yeah, when I was in college, we had seen some UCB shows and had we had someone from IO come up and teach us the Herald.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, that's too hard. And so we would just kind of take a word and then do we would do an Armando, but then 45-minute shows.
Yeah.
Which were torture and I'm sure gameless.
Very same thing for someone had read, must have been Truth in Comedy or something. And so we tried to figure out how to do a Herald from that, which is useless. There's no, that is not how, you're not going to figure it out. And very quickly we were this is unfun. Mm-hmm. So we would just kind of be we'll do scenes and then at the end, just try to bring them together. And that's all that's going to be. And then we started playing around, what if we just doing this, started doing what I now know to be like kind of playing around with forms and working on like what kind of ended up being pretty flowerish, honestly, doing that sort of stuff. But that was, again, like not even really for shows. Like we did a few shows like that, but it was mainly just as a learning tool because it was interesting to us.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like improv shaped your career trajectory of like, oh, I want to do this? Or was it just something that was happening and a supplemental thing? But were you...
Probably until the very end of junior year, didn't have much of a plan, but I probably would have continued on with schooling. I probably would have followed history for longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know what the next step of that was, but that was sort of the plan. Be a historian. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, like go into old libraries that are hidden beneath floors in Venice and uncover ancient secrets.
Yeah, sure. You'd be a Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, that was the plan. But then a friend of mine kind of convinced me to move out here and be like, no, try to act and do comedy and stuff and convince me and Alex Berg to do it. And we were like, oh, okay, yeah, I will if you will. Yeah, all right. So we decided to move out. And that was the first time I'd ever honestly thought at all about doing it outside of school, doing any sort of acting or writing or anything like that. That was the first time it took him, someone to go, you know, you can try doing this. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess I can try doing this. And so I did.
So tell me about your life as an improv student. What were you like as a student, and how is that different from now? Or has it just, you dug deeper into who that person was?
That's interesting. I wonder if maybe I can give my guesses at it, but I would assume I'm probably the least equipped to have the self-awareness to know. But when I was an improv student, I was basically at Iowa West.
Mm-hmm.
Before I moved out here in 2004, and I started taking classes at Iowa West almost immediately. And that was before UCBLA opened. And I mean, I was like all in pretty fast. Mm-hmm. Like I would be at that theater all the time. Rest in peace. And like seeing shows and doing shows pretty fast. So I went through the 6 levels there. I'm sure the improviser that I am was versions of that were there. Like to be the voice of reason and like to kind of play in this sort of heady way. But like I really kind of I enjoy it, but I also kind of believe that there is value to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so like I took it seriously, I'd say, and really wanted to kind of understand what it was that I was doing. And at IO at the time, I had some really great teachers, but there wasn't much of a curriculum. So like you'd get great stuff from Kakowski and or Dassey or whoever your teacher was, and it wouldn't necessarily always like level four didn't necessarily jump off from where you left off at level 3. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of like kind of picking and choosing. The other thing, as I think all young early 20s improv students are, is like, I was like, well, I want to figure out my own thing. And that's part of what kind of became Convoy is we wanted to play fast and we liked playing fast. And now I think that's more default than it was in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
At IO when we were there, it wasn't the way we play wasn't common. Now I think it's much more common.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lot more of like sort of like longer character based, not fully structured stuff. And we kind of wanted to be a little more focused on what we thought was funny and interesting and drive that forward. Now I would say I recognize that as like, oh, we're playing game. Mm-hmm. Pretty tight and swapping games out left and right when we were like, now I want to do that game, now I want to do that. At the time, I didn't have that verbiage, so I didn't really know that's what we were doing. But I think trying to find that voice was a big part of that, my sort of schooling. When I came over to UCB, I took 201 with Seth Morris, and that's sort of where that it was introduced to me. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense with what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you... I mean, since I met you, you have been a teacher and a just an improv legend, dude.
Well, thank you.
But So was Sentimental Lady your first Herald team?
At UCB?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was on a Herald team at I.O.
Mm-hmm.
that was like full of wonderful people, very funny people, and just mm-hmm. like the most mediocre, like one of those things where the each individual should have added up to more.
Uh-huh.
But you, yeah, Sentimental Lady, I auditioned for, I can never remember this. So it would have been, I guess, the spring of 06, I think.
Dang.
And it was invite only for the auditions. I had just finished 201 and we auditioned, and that original version of Sentimental Lady got put together off of that. There were 9 of us.
After 201?
Yeah.
That's bananas.
That was the extent of my UCB schooling.
You didn't take a class after 201?
I took one, like, Chad Carter class. It was improvising and then writing sketch off of the improv. So that was the only other class I took. And I took workshops and stuff.
But sure.
Because I was so fucking broke.
Yeah.
And then I got on this Herald team.
And you're like paying for that.
And I was paying for that. Yeah. And I was like, this is honestly giving me, 301 was Herald and I had some Herald experience. I was like, this is giving me that schooling.
Totally.
And also, even if I wanted to, I probably couldn't have afforded it.
Yeah.
But like that, so the original version of Sentimental Lady, that was me, Berg, Johnny Meeks, Joel Spence, Mel Cowan, Casey Wilson, Leonard Robinson, June Raphael. Am I forgetting someone? Susie wasn't on yet. Todd wasn't on yet. Oh, yeah. And Cale Hartman. I was forgetting someone.
Great.
Yeah.
That's so crazy that, so you've been on that team for 12 years.
Long time. Yeah. That's Johnny Meeks' daughter was born the year we were put together.
Jeez.
Her, his eldest daughter. And it was such a different time, which everyone always says. That's great. Like, it was, it was so fundamentally different. A lot of, I think career-wise, I've been in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was absolutely an example of just happening to be like, I'm going to take a class a few months after UCB opened. And it's going to coincidentally be Seth Morris teaching it. And he's going to be the AD. And mm-hmm. Right place, right time.
Yeah. Wild. So you touched on this a little bit, but how would, for someone who's been around since the birth of UCB LA, how has the improv changed or the scene changed? Is it like a noticeable thing or is
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that made me come over here so like all in the pool from IO, there are a few, but like the main like sort of active positive thing from UCB was that IO to me felt like it was based around this is how we do things and this is the voice and that's going to continue forever. And UCB, through the various ADs over the years, felt like it was changing and trying to do new things. I still think it does. Like mm-hmm. they will adjust. Different voices in the AD slot really make it change and different. And I really responded to that. In those early days, there are a couple major differences and a lot of them stem from there weren't a ton of people trying to perform here. So the people that were could do whatever they wanted, and that obviously dictated the voice. In terms of improv, the things that I think changed the most is I think in those early days, there was a lot of like just sort of aggro-ness.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really my bag, but there's a lot of that sort of like, yeah, we're going to yell mm-hmm. and be destructive and almost to me at times would feel like chasing some even earlier era where it's like, this is punk rock. And
yeah.
Punk rock is never less convincing than when it's reminding you that it's punk rock. And it was because it was an adolescent scene, if that. Like, it was everyone like figuring out, being like, holy shit, this isn't Groundlings. We can do this bonkers weirdo stuff
mm-hmm.
Because we can. And now I think that has kind of faded away in, I think, a good way. I think that should belong to other up-and-coming scenes or whatever.
I think they're, not to interrupt, but I think that was something, as someone who wasn't a big aggro person, I remember I was college friends with Amanda Sitko and mm-hmm. came and saw her Herald team, which was
the most aggro Herald team of all time.
Oh, yeah. Cabbages and Kings.
Yeah,
great
absolutely.
Name.
Yeah.
Excellent name.
Stunning
but
everyone survived that team.
It was very aggro.
Yeah.
And it was, I think it was like a bunch of white dudes and Amanda. So only one woman on a team.
that was about norm for back then, too. Sure, like, definitely. I remember Semi Lady, we had Casey and June, and it was like, oh, two women. Well, look at how progressive we are.
But it was, that has been a change that I have noticed and really embraced of, like, you don't have to be the most aggressive person to mm-hmm. be good at improv. And honestly, you're probably not going to yeah. be if you are that.
And, like, there's room for, you know, I mean, that's the other thing, too. It's like, if that's your bag, that's your bag. But, like, it was a bunch of people who I don't think it was their thing trying to do it. Mm-hmm. And that didn't help. I think one of the reasons Sentimental Lady, there are two reasons I think Sentimental Lady has made it for as long as they did and got out of that initial period. One is, again, right place, right time. When we were put together, there weren't a ton of people. So mm-hmm. during our, like, growing pains where we weren't great, but we were learning, what were you going to swap out with us? You know, you didn't have 600 people auditioning, so we were able mm-hmm. to have more time to figure it out. The other thing is, I think because of that time period, stuff was so aggressive. It feels like I'm shitting on that, and I'm not even necessarily trying to shit on that, but it's just different than mm-hmm. anyone on Sentimental Ladies, especially the what became what it is now with the addition that was with some changes and then with Todd and Susie. We are not a group of seven very aggressive people, like, yeah. you know, like, and I think that's how we played. And, you know, we had some, like, I'm not one of them, but we had some really good actors on the team and it was a little bit thinkier. And I think that helped our team kind of be like, oh, they have a voice because mm-hmm. that's how they play. And that's a little bit different than it was at that time.
And I think, the aggressive improv, perspective is, I think, how improv is still thought of as a yeah. lot of the time.
Or the polar opposite, which is nothing is happening. You know, like that meandery, uh-huh. like I think people see
yeah, we're
it as
gonna
one of,
find, yeah.
Yeah, and like, uh-huh. you know, neither of those are my faves.
Yeah. I was just talking with Jacob both about, like, my big deal right now, the thing that I'm constantly thinking about and looking at is, like, initiating nice and clearly, but also, like, having emotional connections,
yeah.
which is, I think, the stereotypical improv is that meandery, or it's just, like, going so hard and not reacting in an emotional mm-hmm. way. And I think for me, I've seen in my shorter time doing improv, it's been a nice change to see.
Part of it, too,
different
I think,
voices.
Is like those early days for a lot of people, that idea of game was freeing. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people's brains, that can, like, really click for them. Not everybody, but for a lot of people, that really helps. And that kind of allows people to go nuts like that.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with what you're saying. One big thing when I'm teaching now, that anyone who's had me recently, there's two things that I just try to drum over and over and over. And one is that the idea of game is just what you think is funny. And probably the most important word in that is you, that there's no correct thing. Like mm-hmm. people are constantly, what's the game? And they go, oh, well, and they'll say something. I'm like, I don't believe that you think that's funny. So why are you doing it? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I think is holding us back is those two sort of poles that you just described there. One is almost just pure gameplay. And that sort of meanderless sometimes is like just playing the scene. And what happens is people don't do both. You have to do both. And that's why mm-hmm. it's hard. And to emotionally connect to what's happening, you play the game. This is what's funny. And you emotionally react to it. Now you're playing the scene. And then that emotional reaction to the scene will eventually get you to another game move. And then you emotionally react to that. And if you're not doing that, then you're not actually doing the scene. You're sitting around a table and brainstorming funny ideas for a scene to be written later.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not doing that thing, the playing the game and finding what's funny about it, then you're just throwing shit at the wall and seeing what we're watching 3 minutes of just two fake characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to, like, the best scenes or good scenes are ones where those are both played. And I think that's why it's hard, is because you do have to have your brain working in both left brain, right brain.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you're seeing in the indie scene or on Herald Night or just in the improv world right now that is that really peeves you?
Let me think. You know, it's I was coaching Herald teams for ages and ages and ages, and then I took some time off because I have to work. So I haven't been at Herald Night in a few months, so I don't want to speak anything to Herald Night. But in general, okay, here's what pees me, and it comes from a place of, I think, positivity, even though maybe I don't give the note as positive as I could, and it's sort of what I was just saying is I see so many indie shows where people aren't doing what they want. I don't know what they find funny.
Yeah.
And that kills me because I'm like, I know that you at some point got it in your head that there's a thing you should be doing. And there isn't. As long as you're listening, and as long as you're responding, and as long as you're making conscious choices, you'll do it right. And most indie shows I see that aren't great is it's opportunity after opportunity after opportunity getting passed up so that they can play grumpy mom, mm-hmm. which is like the fifth most interesting idea. And it's because they're not listening to themselves. They're not listening to themselves go, okay, this is what I think is funny. And I think that comes from two things. One is I think it comes from self-doubt and being like, well, I don't know. That's a natural process of learning.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think comes from and is a bit of terminology that I don't love is I think the phrase find the game is destructive. And I prefer choose or create the game because that's what we're doing. And I think mm-hmm. whether or not people know it, when you say find the game, that's what leads to those scenes where I'm like, what are you looking for? You have to actively listen and respond and make a choice, and then you get the scene. But if you're just sort of being like, don't worry, we're going to find it, you're not, because we're playing make-believe.
Yeah.
You're not going to find...
Then we're letting stuff pass us by.
Exactly.
Because we're trying to find something that mm-hmm. Feels like it should be better than this. This isn't good enough.
Yes, so we have mm-hmm. to find... And we have to find the game. You step out, there's infinite games.
Yeah.
Until you choose one. And the logic behind saying find the game is a really good thing, which is... Stop bulldozing. Don't force it. That's why we say find the game, because if you say choose the game, then the biggest assholes
yep.
are going to be going, I want to do this. I've got a huge dick. You know, like, and
great
you're like,
game.
Great game. Really funny game. but like, that is why find the game works. So it's almost to me, it's like, hey, level one, level two, go find that game. You know, go find that game.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting into advanced study or on Herald Night or Academy. And now I think we should stop saying that. And I think it starts being like, trust yourself, create the game. I like create because if you and I are doing a scene together, it's not like, hey, Sarah, invent everything. It's just being like, no, you and I are going to work together and one of us is going to decide on, I think what you just said is funny, so I'm going to tell you that in, mm-hmm. in some way. And we're going to be like, hey, we just made the game. We created it. Now we get to play it. And that, to me, makes it active and makes it engaged and makes it based on the choice, not based on the improv gods have deigned to accidentally help you fall into a scene.
Right. And would you say it's, 'cause you talked about like showing off what you find is funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I agree with you, but I think that can sometimes be like, oh gosh, how do I show what I think is funny? Would you say that's in those choices or it's in the justification or what would you say?
I think it's probably mainly in those choices, but that includes in listening because I'm more often going to be able to identify you've said or done something and I found it funny, that's going to be easier for me to go, well, that was funny. Let me make the choice to mm-hmm. underline that for you. And then that stems from listening. I have far more students. I mainly only teach, I don't teach as much as I'd like, but I mainly teach like advanced study and now some academy. And I have far more students at that level. I almost never get a bulldozer.
Mm-hmm.
I almost never get that person, normally a dude who just like jams their ideas through no matter what at that level. I know that is much more common in the yeah. earlier levels. But I get a ton of people who won't make that choice and who can't, who I'm like, mm-hmm. You are a funny person. And when we're doing, if we're talking and doing bits, you can make me laugh. And then you step up out there and all that individuality just washes away.
Yeah.
And I'm absolutely watching an improv scene. And that's never a compliment. If I'm like, I watched an improv scene, that's not like, great. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be tricked into thinking I'm watching something else.
I love that phrase, underline, because that's a phrase I use a lot too.
Yeah.
And I think, talking about the framing the game, I think can be a little heady, but just underlining just says like, hey, you did a funny thing. I want to make sure that you heard it.
Yeah.
Because I think that happens a lot too, where someone says something that is unusual and either they don't recognize it as such.
Oh, yeah.
Or the person that they're with maybe recognizes it, but is like, they probably get it. I'm not going to emphasize it. And then we're past it. Mm-hmm. And then we can't go back to it. I think there's something so... And that happens just the way you do. I feel like a lot of my... when people are struggling with that, I'm like, yeah, when we're at a party and we're like having, when we're doing a bit, when we're like, oh yeah, Cody would totally do this. And then you're like, oh yeah, Cody would do this other thing. Cody, we're making fun of you. I'm so sorry. You're perfect. but we're all pitching on the idea that, you know, Cody loves pajamas or whatever. And so we're all, we're just underlining that. We're saying, hey, this is a funny idea. And I think I feel like students feel like they don't want to call stuff out because they're either being rude or they're being obvious.
Yep.
And I think...
Or they think they're pimping someone. I think there's a big... And again, I don't know a way around this because in 101 or 201, you have more people that are doing that, that are being rude or being, you know, like that happens. And then the people who don't, who stick around and get good are still living in this mindset of, I can't trust... I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be that person. And that's... They're not trusting themselves. When to underline it, like... A underused way to underline is just to go, what? Like nothing underlines the unusual thing more than say what you just said again.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to say that thing again. And you're going to go, that's, yeah, that's fun. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. And me saying what is just going, I think there's something there. And now we can run with that. But people get, you know, they're like, oh, I don't want to, like, we really have to build this brick by brick together in this flowy way instead of just being like, I don't, again, any students that may hear me bitch about this, but I don't think two people can make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
One person can make a decision, the other person can support it and build off of it. And I think that's what improv is.
Sure.
And similarly, there's so many terminologies, so much terminology in improv that I know that was incredibly useful and has gotten less so as it became codified into this, into magic talk.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest offender of that for me is this idea of group mind, which you'll never hear me use because it's not a constructive note. Like if I watch a team and be, oh man, they had such great group mind and that sort of thing. I think that holds students back because what are you supposed to fucking do with that?
Mm-hmm.
I can say they really actively listened to one another and responded. Because that's all group mind is. We can't read each other's minds.
Yeah, that term really stressed me out as a student.
Because you're like, I'm not doing something. My team we're not doing anything right. Like, how do we get that?
Mm-hmm.
You fucking listen to each other. You can listen if I go, hey, make sure you listen. But you can't be like, as a team, I think you should have better group mind. Because that's straight up magic.
Will say I hate the game Mind Meld for that reason. Because it's so frustrating and it's like, we all have different minds.
Yes. And we should.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting is that like we all have different minds and we think different things and I can't read your mind and no matter how much, like to the audience where listening and reacting looks like magic, that's what we're trying to do. Where I say what and then you suddenly know he's telling me that's what the game is and now I'll heighten it. That looks like magic to an audience. But it's just, it's choice based. And I think, you know, a big part of my teaching style and my improv style is like making you make conscious choices because otherwise if you're in a good scene it's by accident.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes students can get caught up in not framing because we're so like don't ask questions in 101 and from then on out, but I think I always, whenever I say don't ask questions, I'm always like, it's 100% okay to ask for clarification, but to underline is so important, and always ask why.
Yeah, I always say the same thing of being like, in general, don't ask questions is a good rule that obviously we're going to break all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It never applies to a question that starts with why. A question that starts with why will 99% of the time get you to something on the other side of the answer that's interesting.
Yeah.
Be it justification or some sort of other piece of information. And I think people, you almost want to go like, okay, 101 and 201 and 3, now that we've learned all those things, hopefully it should be baked into a certain degree. So forget those rules because you know when to do these things. I'll tell you if you're asking too many questions, but I'll never say, don't ask questions. That's for 101.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, let that go, and you'll be better for it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the reason we say don't ask questions is it just puts the weight on your scene partner's shoulders and it delays what could happen. Yeah. So I always describe that. I love whys.
Yeah.
What are some exercises that you that are not for you?
They're not for me.
Yeah. that you don't feel were helpful to you as a student, or that you don't think are helpful for your own students. That people want to do or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. So this is tangential to that question, connected, but and then I'll try to think of some. I don't think jams are useful unless you're someone who's never been on stage and you just need to feel what it is to be on stage.
Oh, interesting.
I think improv jams are, if you're looking at it as like, I'm bored and I just want to dick around, fine. Mm-hmm. I don't think they help you do improv.
Oh.
Except for if you're someone who's incredibly nervous about being on stage and being watched, then sure, get up there. There's, you know, no problem.
I think I will minorly disagree, only because I think doing a jam, I think helps people strengthen their voice of reason.
Mm-hmm.
And having to deal with crazy people and be like, I will justify that.
I find when I've seen jams or when I used to do them now and then, I think it teaches bad habits, because okay. I think most people, even when they're doing that, they're doing it with disconnection for safety.
Mm-hmm.
And they get rewarded for that. So like someone's being a crazy person, like not improv crazy, like legit crazy person has wandered in and is doing improv.
Yep.
And they go, okay, well, I'm going to call that out in a way that puts a wall between me and this character because it's too dangerous. Not physically dangerous, but like mm-hmm. in terms of like I might fail as an improviser for my character to try to connect with this person and voice of reason them. And then you get a lot of like, hold on. you just said, instead of being like, well, what if this character's voice of reason cared about this person?
Uh-huh.
And that's hard to do in a jam. Now, in a perfect world, they would be great.
Mm-hmm.
But just as they tend to play out in real life, I think they are often overstated as a skill builder. I think you're going to get more out of, especially now when there's so much performance mm-hmm. opportunities. I think that's probably different too in cities or scenes where there aren't a lot of performance opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
LA is lousy with improv, so you can get up on stage. And when it opened, another difference, when the theater opened, the jam was one of the only places you could perform. There was no indie scene. There was nothing. So in that case then, it's like, okay, great. You want to do improv? That's your opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
In a place like here, New York, or I presume Chicago, where there are a lot of opportunities and people improvise with you, I think it's better to go, I'm just going to pick five people and do shows with them.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of actually exercises, you know, I think it's even, I'm trying to think of one that I just think is straight up useless.
or the opposite. We can go for something that you really are into and think is
Well, in terms of, I think a lot of times it's helpful to look at like what is useful when, you know, like there's a point where sound and movement becomes useless,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's not right away, because there's a value to being like, let's all look stupid. And there's value to, hey, look, we're pattern-based animals. We can identify pattern fucking anywhere. And look, listening isn't just what words did you say. Now we're all drumming like stupid little raindrops. Great. That's because we were listening and with our eyes and our ears.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to a certain point and you're like, okay, well, what? I'm not going to force you guys. You've been doing, you know, improv for years. I'm not going to make you do sound and movement. Stuff I really like now, I really like exercises that try to help people get to that point where they make a choice. And one of the best versions of that, you do it in 101 or 201. And then there's a version of it I do later where you have two people do a scene and then the back line raises their hand and they identify what they think is the unusual thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the last two people in a scene, in a room normally, to identify the unusual thing are the people doing the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they're worrying about all this sort of stuff. And then in the higher levels, I do that same exercise, but instead of just identifying what's unusual, I have that back line name the game. So they're not in the scene, they're watching, and I have them name the game. And I really think that's useful because it shows them that if there's six people on the back line, they aren't all like, yes, we all have the same game.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Everyone makes that choice differently, and then you can just play it. And I think it helps underline the fact that different humans are going to find different things funny and identify games different way. That's a feature, not a bug. And it shows you that it's there, right? Mm-hmm. The back line sees it. So don't ignore it when you're in the scene. I promise you it's there. That's all Convoy's show is I think that's funny. Now we're going to do that for a little while. I think that's fun. Like every tag is either exploring a funny thing that one of us identified or identifying a new funny thing in the scene we just saw and spinning that off into a new game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like... what was I going to say? I am always encouraging people to try to name the game in their scenes mm-hmm. because that is... because it is, we all have different ideas of what game is, and my game idea might be here, and your game might be like a half step away. They're so similar, but because they're different, our second beat ideas or the choices that we make are going to be different and weird. And the sooner we can, just it feels like a cheat, but I'm always like, say it out loud.
I think you have to because mm-hmm. it's. Let's use this for the population at large. If you've been improvising together. I bet TJ and Dave don't have to fucking say it. You know what I mean? Because like when you know someone that well, fine. But for most people, yeah, you have to say it loud because that one tiny degree difference where that first scene, let's say it's a hero, that first beat's going great because we pretty much know, but no one said it. If you're even a little bit off, the whole point of most improv forms is you heighten that game. Mm-hmm. And when you heighten it, that one little degree difference is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And you're going to swing for the fences on some big heightening. And the other person's going to be like, what are you doing? because we've never said, hey, this is what it is.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about you're on Convoy. You're on Sentimental Lady. Mm-hmm. What do you find yourself improvising differently in each of filling different roles? Or just talk about. How you like improvising with
that? Yeah, it probably feels more different to me than to an audience, but sort of the goals of Convoy, I think it's very important for any improv group or team, even if an improviser, just to know sort of what your goals are. Like, what does this team do, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think we aim for different things between Convoy and Sentimental Lady. In Convoy, the idea is we get that suggestion. We never wipe at it. We never start again. We just tag out and we see how far can we get away from that suggestion through scenes? How many different types of games can we create from that one word? And in Sentimental Lady, in the first half, we do kind of a montage from an interview. In the second half, we do a pretty flower. It's almost maybe a different type of exploratory. And it's a little bit more like, well, let's really dig into the, especially in the pre-flower, these characters when we're really doing what we set out to do. And that ends up being a little bit of a different goal and a little different style of play. I mean, it might just be my own perception. People might be like, no, you play exactly the same in both. but I would say in Sentimental Lady, I'm more likely to, like in Convoy, I'm more aggressive. There's also only three of us, so you kind of have to be aggressive going all mm-hmm. the way through. And in Sentimental Lady, I kind of enjoy playing more where it's a little bit more of like taking little things other people said and finding ways to have that spiral out into one big thing that we can play over half an hour. Mm-hmm. Comes from the same place, but it does feel different to me, those two different shows. And versus like, I perform with Jacob Wysocki and Hillary Matthews with Jaw from time to time, mm-hmm. and that's, I play wildly different there than I do with those two. I play with my wife Deborah Tarica on puzzles, and that is wildly different. I used to do shows with Dominic Dirkus, and that was so those all felt very different. I would play in different ways, but not even consciously. I don't think I'd set out to do it. I think it would just be, well, this confluence of voices are all asking different things, so I'm going to meet them different. Like Jaw is wilder and weirder mm-hmm. because it's Jacob and Hillary and it's all three of us needling each other to be as weird as we can be. Mm-hmm. And that's different than Sentimental Lady, where we're going to be like, let's try to like really build this scene up.
How did Jaw form?
Hillary and Jacob asked me to do the 3-on-3 tournament. Great. And I said yes. and it was fun. So now when people ask, we do shows and it's super fun.
Great.
Yeah.
So do you do a lot. You don't do a ton of indie shows anymore, I assume.
I do almost, if I'm free and someone asks me to do it, I do it. Like, because I know, you know, me and Berg and Tyler are very nerdy, and we like it. Like, and when Convoy does indie shows, you know, we normally do a Herald now, and we try to do something we don't get to do. I don't, like, between Puzzles and Jaw, I do a fairly regular amount, but I'm not, you know, like, I feel bad taking up too many slots for people that don't perform as much as me. But I really love performing at shows that are run just for the love of it. That's a different energy, and it's the I like reminding, like, this is a weird, dumb thing that we're all doing. And in, like, the clubhouse or some little black box theater, and people are just running it because, like, it's fucking fun as hell and they want to put on a good show. Like, it's very hard for me to say no to that. So even when people ask me to do shows, if I say no, I'm always like, but please ask me again, because I will want to do this show.
Yeah. Yeah. I find that, a lot of times, especially like later night indie shows, it's always hard to get to. And then once I'm there, I'm like, I'm so glad I came. This is so fun.
It's also Convoy's at 11:30 at night on a Thursday.
Sure,
so like I've got baked into me, like, hey, you're not always going to be performing at the time you want. So like I'm pretty willing to show up. Uh-huh. You know, it's mainly drive. Someone was like, hey, I'm doing a show in, you know, Long Beach. I might be going, no.
Yeah.
But on this side of town, like, I think it is fun. I also very much think you have to be, improv is a young person's game, and you can calcify and be like, this is the sort of improviser I am, and I'm never going to do anything else interesting ever again. And you don't know you're doing it, but it absolutely happens. And I think the way to avoid it is to be around people doing other things than you, and the people doing different things than you aren't your generation. And they aren't older, they're younger. And so, like, to see the clubhouse and to see what's happening at in indie shows and get like, oh, okay, this is the vibe now. Like, that's so funny the way these people are playing. I love that. How can I fold that into what I do? Is really helpful. And to see that world change, you know, the indie scene here went from nothing to being like, there's TNT just alone for years, doesn't get enough credit for, like, really creating an indie scene. And then, like, Crash Bar and Room 101 and, like, and all those independent ones started. 101 used to do those weirdo theme shows, like the one in the hotel room. And one of the best, my favorite shows I've ever done, which was the car show, where it was three people would get in a car and the driver and the passenger seat would be improvisers. And you'd drive around and you'd do a 20-minute mono scene with the audience in the back seat.
They
just ran a bunch of cars. And Deb and I did that, and we would give my iPod to someone in the back. They'd pick a song. That would be the suggestion, and we would just improvise that way. And, like, that scene of, like, really creative, interesting types of indie shows was really big. Now it's a little more, like, okay, based around the clubhouse and doing this sort of thing. I think that sort of interesting stuff is going to come up again. And every time that shift has happened, it's made me a better improviser because I'd be like, you know, this makes me sound... I'm not old, but I'm getting older. But, like, so this makes me sound like an old man, but, like, it forces me to go, I got to keep up with the kids. Otherwise, why should I presume anyone gives a fuck about whether or not I'm funny? Like, I have to pay attention to what they're doing.
Is there anything in the indie scene right now that, because you talked about going and to indie shows and being energized by their energy and their love of it and kind of being inspired by that. Is there anything that you've seen, either a specific show or a specific team or just kind of an energy that has inspired you recently that you're like, oh, that's a thing I'd like to bring to my own improv or my teaching?
Yeah. I think it came through indie shows where I've been the last couple classes and I haven't quite figured out how to teach it. But that idea of people not doing the scenes anymore came from both watching normal indie shows and seeing it and then seeing indie shows that I think are honestly a reaction to that. So if I see, like, Catharsis was that like, I might still exist, I'm not sure, but, like, it was a dramatic improv. And I think that comes from, well, what this is giving us is something we're not getting in our normal shows. That can stand out because people aren't doing dramatic scenes with comedy on top. They're just not doing dramatic scenes. They're doing very improv-y scenes. And I think, like, that show and then doing, it's different, but, like, dramedy is a fun show where, like, the guests, you watch a clip from a movie and then you improvise based on that. But even just connecting into that movie, it tends to draw genre out of people mm-hmm. and force them to play like that. And the host team, Some Kind of Monster, does this, like, Law and Order procedural form, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's very fun. And I've seen a bunch of shows like that, that whether or not they know, I think what they're saying is, great, we get game. What about the rest of the stuff? And it might be genre, and it might be just like really committing to that seriousness. And I that reminded me that you have to. I can't, like, a lot of the times I can go out there and I can just kind of be funny, half-assed funny, and not feel terrible because the audience will react to that. But that's not interesting, and that's not pushing myself. Mm-hmm. Whereas some of these shows where it's like, okay, you watch this clip from The Thing, and I have to initiate this. I need to convey that we are in the world of this weird movie. That's a muscle that I have to work. And then I start looking for that in my students. I'm going like, no, you're working that muscle. And then I have to go like, okay, great. Do a genre scene. And they go, I don't know what that is. And I go, great, we've got a problem.
Yeah. That brings up an interesting thing I wanted to chat about, which is what do you think outside of just doing more and seeing more improv enriches your improv life? Because I think there are so many, and I was this student as well, who I was in five improv groups that all practiced during the week. So I had five improv practices, and I was like just seeing so much improv, and it just was like a snake eating its own tail.
I think reading and writing, like one of the first like when people are blocked in improv, and sometimes students will talk to me, and one of the main things, like a lot of times I'll be like, and especially if people are struggling with the idea of game, is that the first thing I'll ask them is, do you write? And if the answer is no, then be like, start. Like, even if that's not what you want to do, force yourself to write. It will make you a better improviser. And it doesn't have to be like sketch. It can be anything. Mm-hmm. But write, because words matter and ideas, and getting ideas out of your head will make you a better improviser, whatever way that comes. And then reading, I think, is as crucial as any improv class. If you aren't absorbing new information about the world, and that doesn't mean nonfiction, that means novels, mm-hmm. It means poetry, whatever you want. If you aren't absorbing that, then you're going to be blocked. And you're going to have nothing to bring to that stage on year five of doing improv besides 5 years of improv.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very easy, accessible thing for everybody to do. Beyond just like living your life and like making sure that my life isn't improv, and I've done that. Like, start out that way, great. Let's call it, once you're out of the core classes, start making sure that there's other shit going on.
Yeah.
I
was encouraged to, like, go see a play.
Yeah.
Go to the observatory. Or
absolutely.
Something. Be a human.
And this is, I'm not one of those big like, and all the skills of improv affect you in life. But one thing I am about that is like, I do not believe as human beings we are born knowing how to collaborate. And at its core, all improv is teaching you how to collaborate. And start to realize how that manifests itself in your life and in other ways of being like, okay, how do people work together, and how can I learn from other people, and how can I spit that out and use that?
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you have to be around other people, and you have to be doing other things. Because if it's just sort of being like, we're doing group games every day, all day, then that you're gonna start to repeat yourself. But if you're like, no, you know what? I'm fucking really interested in space. I'm going to be at the observatory a bunch and be around that different subculture. Or like, that will help you on this side. Mm-hmm. Every great improviser that anyone can think of has outside interests, and it factors into their improv. No one has ever looked at an improviser and been like, the thing about them that's so great is they're just improv. Like, that's not a feather in your cap. That's like, oh, bummer. Like, same thing with writers. Like, you know, you need to have a inner life that you can then show, here's the individual I am, and that's why you want to watch me improvise and why I'm different from other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's so important to try and get out. Try and talk to friends who don't do improv.
Yeah.
I was just talking with Jacob about this, how I think being in the improv community, which is, you'd learn to support each other. It's one of, it's maybe the best comedy community, because we're all supporting each other and trying to, you've got your thing. I'm so happy for you. I know my thing is coming, but,
it's, and I mean, I never did New York, so I don't know, but like, so I've only known this world in LA really. And it is shockingly encouraging. And everyone can point to other, you know, to the counter examples, but compared to most other creative endeavors, like I've just haven't encountered like a lot of people being like, God, that should have been fucking mine. You know what I mean? Like people can be bummed they didn't get something, but you just don't see a lot of like, why is this person successful and I'm not? Like, and when you do, those people tend to wash out. That's a horrible way to live.
Yeah.
Really brutal way to live that I that would make me like crumple and die under the weight.
Very hard.
Yeah.
One thing before we kind of wrap up, I imagine your low shows, the shows that you do that suck, are less than they used to be. But when you have those, what are ways that you deal with that?
Yeah. I'm not sure I would agree that they're, from my perspective, I probably feel as bad about as many shows as I ever did. One of the way, the like probably the most helpful way is I do another show.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to say when I've got two weekly shows,
sure.
But I can knock it loose that way. The other way I do it is I try to think critically about why something doesn't work without beating myself or the team up for it. I try to go like, this didn't work because we didn't do this thing. And not being mad or like upset about that, but being like, oh yeah, okay, well, if I can identify that, that probably means that I can fix it, you know? And and I view improv very much as like, I think I would go crazy without it to a certain degree, because in this town, in this industry, you get no all the time. And, you know, it's fun to create. And it's a thing of pure creation. You're just creating something with low stakes and no one can say no. And like for me, like when I do those bad shows, that's also part of that. Like I go, oh, okay, great. Yeah, that sucked. I just did what I fall back. I did all my go-tos. Mm-hmm. That was boring. I got to fix that. I just try to be honest with myself about that. And everyone goes, even now I go through peaks and valleys where I'm like, oh, I think I'm worse than I used to be. maybe I should stop doing this. And then inevitably I'll do another show where I was like, that's so fun. Mm-hmm. Also, when I get in that real rut, I try to play with new people.
Yeah.
Like when I started playing with Jaw, I was kind of in that. And then they asked me to do that. I was like, this will be good for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it really truly was. Like, because again, I'm learning from playing with Jacob and Hillary, or I'm learning from playing with Dominic or whatever. And it forces me to develop different tools, and that helps me. Then I bring those over to whatever else I'm doing.
Do you find that are you giving the note to teams that you're coaching or classes that you find that you are working on yourself?
I probably give a lot of like really commit and act, like make me believe that scene a lot, because that's probably the first thing that goes if I'm half-assing it, is I'll just like, witty line, just toss out like, what's this? You know, be my like smug self.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to get people to not do that quite a bit. I try. Maybe this is bad. Maybe this is destructive. I haven't thought about this. I try to not think of myself when teaching, and I think the most important thing about teaching and coaching is my only job is to make it easier for you to be you. Which sounds like a kindergarten thing. I just said I've never said that out loud, but that sounds like something. Yeah,
good and important. I think that's for any of the arts. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important note.
I think it's sometimes coaches or teachers can miss that element of it. I don't, if I have 16 people in the class, I don't want any of them improvising like me. I want them improvising like those 16 individuals. And so,
sure.
You know, all my experience comes in to just being like, okay, what did you want to do? Let's figure out a way that you can do that with a higher success ratio and where you can have more fun doing that thing. Even if I'm like, that's not what I would do. That's not what I think is funny. That doesn't fucking matter. You know, I'm there to help you. So I try to keep my own shit down, but of course I'm a human being, so I'm sure it bubbles up left and right. I'm constantly going like, what if you did it more in the way that I like?
Uh-huh.
You know, like even if I'm trying not to.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of a constant struggle.
Is there an improv form that you don't get to do that you would like to see more or would like to do more?
Oh, gosh, I'd love to do more Harolds. Mm-hmm. I really like Harold gets a bad rap.
Well, you're speaking to the right person. I love a Harold.
It's so fun if you approach it right. Like so many theaters do like the Harold Knight sort of model. Mm-hmm. Semi Lady was bad at Harold, fine at Harold's. And then at the end, we got good. And it took us like 3 years. Last Day of School was so good at Harold. And part of it is, I think, what makes it hard on that sort of like, I do think knowing that someone is watching and judging you strips away some of the fun of it. And that mm-hmm. makes Harold Knight harder. So I've said this before, but I don't think Harold's are hard. I think Harold Knight is hard.
Sure.
Because you have that, oh, I'm being judged. Mm-hmm.
Every time you do a scene that is bad, you're like, oh.
Fuck yeah, god damn.
I will still do scenes that we did a scene the other week that I walked off stage and was like, oh, Casey Faye's going to be so mad at us.
Yeah.
Casey wasn't there. He's not watching. He doesn't care, but he wouldn't like that scene.
Yeah, it's so weird. But like when you do a good Harold, I don't know. It just frees up my brain to know what's going to come next, so I get to be more creative. Mm-hmm. It is why I defer to doing Pretty Flowers, which have that sort of structure where you know structurally what's coming, which means you can blow it the fuck out because you'll never be lost. If you're comfortable in the Herald, you can do the craziest shit in the world because you always have the path to come back on. Mm-hmm. And so like I would love to do more Heralds, but also, I mean, look, I don't have time to rehearse it, so I'm not going to half-ass it. Convoy will do it every now and again, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. But like, I've got a kid coming, so I don't think I'm going to get more time to like. Let's just put together a group of people want to improvise Harolds.
They did that 20-year anniversary Harold night, and I got I think someone dropped out, and I got a text like the day of that was like, "Could you do this?" And I was like, "I don't care that I wasn't originally on the list." Yes, and it was so fun.
So fucking fun.
I mean, because there's something it feels so dumb, but just like being able to come back for a second beat and a third beat. Like, we'll do that sometimes in shows. I do that in shows sometimes. But to know I love the structure of it and I love the freedom of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I did that show too. And like my group was like, I got real lucky with this group. It was like Heather Campbell, I think Gemberling, Mandzukas. Like it was just people that I'm like, this is... Mm-hmm. Like I'm nervous and shy. I think maybe Will Hines. It was just like these people that I really love watching. And it was so fun because everyone was just like trying to do the best Harold they can. And these are all people who've already developed their sense of humor. That's where sometimes the Harold gets stuck, is if you don't know what you think is funny, Harold's going to be brutal to you. Years ago, when Robin Williams was just like dropping into the theater all the time, mm-hmm. he did a Harold with Sentimental Lady because he was like, can I sit in with someone? And we were like, abso-fucking-lutely.
Yes.
And so very quickly, he warmed up with us and we were like, do you know what Harold is? And he's like, no. And so like, okay, we're still going to try and do this. Let us explain it to you. And was it a tight, perfect Harold? No. But it was, we know his voice. And he tried to apply his voice to what we were trying to present to him the show was. Mm-hmm. And then we all supported him. And it made it like, you know, I'll remember that forever, partially because it was Robin Williams, but also because of, oh yeah, like this is fun. Like, why are we making this such fucking work? Yeah. Like, this shouldn't be work. This should still be fun. And it's not constraining unless there's some other element of the form that is constraining your scene work, which there shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. I think people get, they get in their heads about the structure of it, mm-hmm. and knowing, okay, I'm going to save some for later because we have to do a second beat of this. And I feel like I'm always pushing to just go as far as you can in that first beat until you're edited. Because you'll find something. And I think a lot of it is not feeling confident in being able to name the game.
Yeah.
And I'm all about recently just like, what is funny and why is it funny?
Yeah.
And that's our game.
That's it. And that's all you need to do. And if I was in some sort of work, I snap my fingers and I could make, this is how improv is taught. Mm-hmm. I would probably do like you do 101, you do 201, you do 301, you learn the Harold. You do 401 and you don't fucking mention the Harold once. And then you come back in 501 and you do the Harold again. Mm-hmm. Like, you learn the basic structure and then you run away from it. And whatever that next thing is just about fun, finding the comedy, doing that sort of thing. And then you synthesize those two things. Because I think people are just wrapping their head around what game is. And then we go, and now I'm going to throw this form on you, and there's a right way and a wrong way to do it.
Yeah.
I did air quotes, but you can't see if you're listening.
They're there, folks.
Yeah, and that's too much. That's too much when people are still going, what's my voice?
Yeah. You know, I feel like in a similar way, I wish there was like a 101, 201, 201A.
Yeah, yep.
Because just to like solidify game, because yeah, I feel like I got there. I taught like an intensive people who take it. I mean, God bless you, but like don't take a 201 intensive
brutal
course.
Yeah.
Because we are teaching your brain how to work in a way that it's never worked before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
And it's teaching 201, I constantly am like, it's okay to feel weird and like this is hard, because it is.
Yeah.
But to embrace it and be like, it's okay to do that, but like we're going to do our best. Because I think people get caught up in it and then they think they're alone and then they think that they're the only ones that don't get it.
And I think they think that, understandably so, I did too, but like it's very hard to convince people. We're not teaching you how to be funny. We're teaching you how to apply the ways in which you're already funny into into a screenplay or into a script or into whatever else. We're helping you take your sense of humor and put it into some form so that you can express it. Mm-hmm. That's it. And I would hope that would help strip away some of that fear from people, where it's like, oh, I have to be funny in a way that this teacher wants, instead of being like, no, do your thing. And then just listen to the note and see how it applies to your sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And see how it applies to what you want to do.
I think that's something that caught me even on my first Herald team, my second Herald team, was like, oh, I'm not being funny in the way that I wanted to be funny.
Yeah.
When I couldn't just recognize I should be funny in the way that I am funny.
Yeah.
I want to be me at my best, but I'm never going to be, you know, you.
Yeah.
Our brains are just different.
Different brain. And mm-hmm. like and if that wasn't true, what a waste of time.
Yeah.
Why would we be fucking doing this? Like
yeah.
the wonderfulness of it is that you can get Zach Woods and Nicole Byer and Betsy Sodaro and Joe Wengert all doing the quote unquote same thing. And what each one of them does is going to be fundamentally different from any other one. But they mm-hmm. all know how to now synthesize those things and work together, because the ways in which to express this we're helping with. But you're all going to find different funny things, and that's why you're interesting. That's what makes it worth doing.
I guess that's our time.
Yeah.
This has been just so wonderful.
This is very fun.
Yeah, this
is a pleasure.
God, I could talk about improv every moment of my life.
Yeah.
Alex, where can people find you?
I suppose you can find me on Twitter at Fernie, Alex, all written out. You can see me performing at the Theater All Time with Convoy and Semi Lady and Required Viewing, which is a movie screening show we do in the Inner Sanctum. It's really fun. And let's see. Oh, you know what? Because no one... I thought it was really good. No one ever saw it. Last year, I made a show. I worked on the show that Rob Hubel created called Do You Want to See a Dead Body on YouTube Red. I legit think it's very, very good. No one really saw it because it was on YouTube Red, but it's really funny, and check it out.
Check it out. Thanks. And that was a long form conversation. Tune in for our next episode when Alex Fernie will be our host. I'll be gone for the week, but I'll be back for the rest of time. Don't worry. Thank you so much. You can find me at Claspy if you want to or don't. Have a great day.
You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting-edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at ucbtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy.